right, we're continuing our class on Ecclesiastes in here, and we've kind of introduced the book last Wednesday. And who did we talk about writing this book? Solomon, right? We talked about there are some other options, but the most likely is, and what tradition has said, is that Solomon was the most likely. And some of the reasons we talked about was verse 1, and then some other information as we read through the first couple chapters that lends itself easily to Solomon being the person that wrote this. And what do we've talked classically, the thought about Ecclesiastes. When we start thinking about Ecclesiastes and this book, what has kind of generally been the thought of this? Is it like really exciting like Song of Solomon, or what is Ecclesiastes known for? Everything's vanity. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, right? And it's been sort of like more of a somber tone, right, than some of the other writings. Where the Proverbs, you go through and there's kind of, you know, just these one after another, and there are different chunks of thematic theme Proverbs, but Ecclesiastes has been one that has been more somber. And we'll start to see it kind of pull out of a nosedive here. We'll start to see some more of a positive light. We actually kind of start off with that. We ended in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 22, or 23 rather, and we're going to be getting in, starting in chapter 2, verse 24, the secret of satisfaction, right? So those who sang the song needed to read Psalms or read Ecclesiastes to find out how to get satisfaction. So we're going to look at the gift of God, right? What are we looking at here? Chapter 2, verse beginning of verse 24. There's nothing better. Do your ears perk up when you read that? There's nothing better. And you can fill in the blank, right? You all have your things, right? We're actually going to read that three times tonight. That's three times in our text. But this first, and all of them kind of in the same thing. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and to tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, and it is from the hand of God. Now, we said earlier in the introduction to this book that there are some that believe that Solomon's teaching Epicureanism, which what did we say was Epicureanism? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, right? I believe the new fashioned way of saying that is YOLO, right? So you only live once, so let's just live it up. So some of you are looking at me like, what are you talking about? Anyway, so here he is. Is he teaching that, though, in this passage? Is he teaching that? Why is he not teaching that? Some of you are shaking your head no. Why would you say no? Yeah, he's not saying it's useless, and he's saying it's from God. Is God giving us stuff just to YOLO with? No, it's not. That's not God's purpose, right? There's nothing better for a man than to eat, drink, and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen it. It's from the hand of God. If I can live a life that I have enough to eat, I have enough to live, and I'm content with those things, is that a blessing? We're going to see later on in our study this tonight about somebody who's chasing after things and their eye is never full. We've read that earlier in this book. But their eye is never full. They're never satisfied. They're never content. They never get to a point where they can just rest from their labors and I'm doing a good thing. I feel. And so he said, that's a blessing from God. Why does he say that? Verse 25, why does he say that? Why does he say it's from the hand of God? According to verse 25. Who can do these things? Who can eat without, and who can have enjoyment without, capital H, him? Who are we talking about? God, right? Who can have these kind of things without God? So it is the person that recognizes that the things that are good in my life, the things that I have that I can be content with, those things are there because of God, and I can be content because of him. It says, verse 26, for a person who is good in his sight and has given wisdom, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, I would, this is contrary. Look over in chapter 1, verse 18. What does it say about much wisdom in verse 18 of chapter 1? It's grievous, right? It's grievous. I got the sun like right on me. It's grievous. But how is that contrasted here? Why is it different here? Any thoughts? This is from God. This is God's wisdom. Is it grievous to have great wisdom and what God is in God's wisdom? No, that's something completely different. So he's contrasting here. This is a person who is good in his sight, capital H. He has given wisdom. God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Solomon can kind of attest to that, right? He was a person that could attest to getting wisdom from God. Now, who does he contrast this with? So here's a person that's good in the sight of God, and then it contrasts with somebody else. The sinner. What does it say about the sinner? This open book. What does it say about the sinner? Yeah, the sinner has given a task, gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. So it appears that even those who, well, this sounds kind of weird, but those, does it mean that all those who sin serve those who are good? Is that what that text is saying? Not necessarily, because we know that's not true, right? We know that ain't happening. But what we can say, can we reap a benefit from those? Can those who are erring sinners, who don't have a relationship with God, can we have a benefit from those people? Yes, there can be a benefit from those people. And, you know, so that's what he's saying, that those who are striving are working and working and working, spinning their wheels, they don't know who they're working for. So what we understand is every good and perfect gift comes from God. Everything. The rain falls upon and the sunshine falls upon the just and the unjust. Right? There are things that people receive benefits from God just because God is great and God is awesome. We are not in a situation where if you're good, you get good things, and if you're bad, you get bad things. We know that's not true. Right? That is not how life works. But because of those things, even people who are wicked, we can be blessed by those. And God uses those people, even though they don't follow Him, He uses them to bless us. Right? That still happens. How many of you have jobs? Right? Is your employer, are they members of the Lord's church and in good standing with God? But are you blessed by them? Right? So there's a lot of different things. Some of them are maybe, but you see where I'm going with that, right? There are blessings that we can get. Now, Chapter 3, we're starting into this. The band is the birds, by the way. I think some of you mentioned it last time. It's the birds. I researched. So here we have this, you know, passage, the rhythm of God is what we've got it titled here. And here is this first kind of statement that's mentioned, a general assertion. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under the sun. Would you say that's true? Right, it's in the Bible. I can't say no, right? But it's not a trap. But in general, and generally, those things are true. Even nature says that, right? Even nature, God has made the world. When He set the world in order, He put what to rule the day and what to rule the night, and the sun and the moon, right? He put everything to have seasons and everything to have order. Could you imagine living in a life where I don't know if the sun's coming up tomorrow or the moon's coming up tomorrow, and tomorrow I don't know if it's going to be hot or cold, and I don't know if it's. Could you imagine trying to live in a world where there's just chaos? But God put everything in order, put everything in its place. And then He starts to have these, God put all these things in motion, all right? God put life as it is for us in motion. And so then begins to have there's these 14 pairs that we have in this section. And the first few begin to live kind of with death and dying. And He says, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up. And so we have this destruction kind of to life kind of idea. And it's what's interesting in the early manuscripts, the earliest manuscripts we have of this section of Ecclesiastes, they have the one side, there's seven on one side and seven on the other, and they put them across from one another. They don't do it like we have. They put them across from one another so we can see them together here. So we have birth and death, plant and uproot, right? What does Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27 say? Is it appointed unto man to pay taxes? No, to die once, right? Once to die, right? So that we know that happens. Everybody's going to die. And we'll talk about that theme later on this evening. But everybody's going to die. Everybody is born and everybody dies. Things are planted and then things are uprooted. And, you know, Deuteronomy chapter 32, 39 even says there is a time for killing. There can be righteous killing. It's not talking about just wanton murder. So that's Deuteronomy 32, 29, if you want to write that out there. And there's a time to tear down, you know, sort of an old building, an old tower, something that's dangerous. Even, did you know that if your house in that time got mold, that you'd have to, like, the priest would have to come in and inspect that mold. And if it was a certain kind of mold, you'd have to wash it. Or even take your house apart brick by brick and wash the bricks and put it back together again. Let's do that on the weekend, right? I mean, come on. So there were times to tear things down and build things back up. And then it talks about another section, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. And those we can understand, right? We understand. We kind of, like, on day-to-day basis, we're kind of right there, right? But this next one, I'm going to just throw this out to you. I have no answer for you. Just heads up. A time to throw stones and a time to gather up stones. Incidentally, the birds didn't really sing about that one, right? But what's that all about? What are your ideas about stones, throwing them and gathering them up? Any ideas on that? So two of you went right to stoning, right? Stone him, right? So the two of you went right. Yes, there is that. You know, I didn't even think about that till later tonight. I was just sitting there pondering it myself. It's like, oh yeah, they stone people, right? There's a time to kill folk and because they've done wrong, and a time to get ready to kill them, right? Just gather stones. What are some other ideas about that? Any other idea? Okay, let me just throw this out there for you. Throw it out there. This is neither right nor wrong. It just is, all right? An idea. How many of you have seen children at play, especially beside a creek or stream, and there's a bunch of rocks? What are they going to do? They're going to start throwing those rocks, aren't they? If there's a pile of rocks and there's kids within a mile of that pile of rocks, they're going to find those rocks and they're going to do what with them? Whether you tell them not to or otherwise, they're going to start throwing rocks, right? So maybe there's a time for play and a time not for play, right? A time for play and a time for work. I don't know, right? We don't have an answer there. Another idea is that they used to throw stones in people's vineyards whenever they would take over an area. They would fill it full of salt and stones and that kind of stuff so they couldn't grow an area. That wasn't that common, you know, a thing. But the stoning people was maybe more common and those kind of things. But anyway, that's there. We don't know exactly what he's trying to get at. I think that's a cultural thing. We're kind of another idea. Yes, ma'am.
I grew up in Michigan where there were a lot of stones. Mm-hmm. So the kids would have to gather the stones out of the field.
Yes.
Before we planted, and then we would use them to build fences or something.
Yes. And so there is that as well. I mean, you've heard as far as pulling stones out of a field and using them for the walls and that kind of stuff. So there's pulling stones and stacking them up. And so work and that kind of stuff. So those are some of the ideas maybe that are thrown in there. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up what is lost. There's even a parable about that. A time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together. That's probably more to do with an old things that are worn out, patchwork, and then sewing things together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. We know that is a truth. But sometimes we mix them up, right? Sometimes when I should be quiet, I talk, and sometimes when I should talk, I am silent, right? And sometimes we don't have the wisdom to know when to do the other one. Proverbs writes a lot about that, right? Proverbs chapter 17, verse 28 talks about a time to be silent. Job chapter 2, verse 13 talks about his friends being quiet for a time. And then chapter 32, verse 4. And Proverbs also talks about a time to be wise in speech. Proverbs 15, 23. Proverbs 15:23 and chapter 25, verse 11 as well. So there's a time to do those things. But having the wisdom to know when to do them is sometimes the trick. That's sometimes the key, right? And then a time to love and a time to hate. Is there ever a time where I can hate something? Can I hate? Does God give me permission to hate? What are y'all saying?
Hate sin.
Hate sin, right? What's the bumper sticker? Hate the sin, not the sinner, right? So that's, you know, maybe it's just me. Okay, so there's that, right? There's that. But God says, I hate every wicked way, right? I can hate those things that are wicked and evil. I mean, there's a time to do that. So there's time for both of these things, time to love and a time to hate, time for war and a time for peace. And then he goes into verse 9, kind of conclusion. What profit is there for the worker? from that in which he toils. Is there ever a rest? While I'm working here, is there ever a rest? No, we cycle through, right? We cycle through, and that's kind of an homage back to chapter 1, verse 3. He kind of opens up with this kind of idea, right? Is there ever a time for rest? All right, now we're going to start another section here, if you guys are good. Start looking at another section here. I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. We're not done with this concept of time, by the way. We're not done yet. He talks about this quite a bit. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out with the work of which God has done from the beginning even to the end. And so we have here this kind of contemplation of God's work. I've seen the task which God's given us. In Genesis chapter 3, what kind of task was given? Genesis chapter 3, man sinned, and God gave them what? What did he say was going to happen? You're going to survive by the sweat of your brow, right? You're going to be working, right? That is sort of our lot, is what's being passed down to us. So that there's that, and that's what we're given. But what does it seem to, that everything still has its time, everything has its place. God has given, as it says, eternity in our hearts, which exactly what that is, we don't know, but he does not mention that having been given to the animals either. Right? So he set eternity in our hearts, separates us from animals in that way. But there is a limit. What is that limit in verse 11? Is there a limit to what we can know? Yes. God says, you're not going to know everything. Right? You're not going to know everything. If you want to write a verse out there, Deuteronomy 29:29, write that out there. That should be one of your go-to verses, right? If somebody ever asked you a question and you do not know the answer, or somebody asks you a question and there is no answer to the question, right? Like those what-if questions, you need to look at Deuteronomy 29:29. That needs to be, that's right, the secret things belong to God, right? That's your go-to, right? That should be on a quick draw if you need that one. All right? So Deuteronomy 29:29. There are certain things we're just not going to know. Can we be content with not knowing? And some things ignorance is bliss, right? We've already established that. We can be content in not knowing certain things. I can be obedient and not know why. How many of you as children ever asked, like, why all the time? Like, yes, that was the answer, right? Because I said so. Like, that was my, I asked why one time, and then I was instructed that it doesn't matter, right? With quite a firm response. It doesn't matter if I say why or not. If I say it, you do it, right? And so that's the response. It doesn't matter. God says this is what we need to do. This is what we should do, right? And it doesn't necessarily matter why. And some of the things, we're not going to have the answer why. And some things we don't even need to know why, right? So anyway, we're getting off subject. But that's what he's talking about, contemplating God's work. This is what he's given us to do. And again, verse 12, we have this again. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Do we trust Solomon in this? He's going to say it again in verse 22. Of this chapter. Do we trust Solomon in what he's saying? What had he done earlier in this book that we kind of looked at? He went through some trial and error kind of things, right? I tried women, wine, and song. Right? I've done all this different stuff, and it is what? Vanities, right? I tried great wealth. You know, I took it upon myself. I'll take one for the team. And do all these things. And at the end of all that, he says it's the simple life of living your life, being content with what you have, and understand that your blessings come from God, and live and know that the work you're doing is good. If I can have those things, I am richer than Solomon ever has ever been. Yet what are we told? What are we sold over and over again? No, you can't be content. That's crazy. How old is your cell phone? That's insane, right? You can't be content with those things. But again, that's the lie that's being sold. Otherwise, we just, you know, wouldn't be market for anything. So chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God, right? And James chapter 1, verse 17 talks about that every good and perfect gift comes from above. So we know that those things. And then he says in verse 14, he says these several statements. He says in verse 12, I know that there's nothing better. What does he say in verse 14? What does he know? What does he can? Everything God does will remain forever. He is assured of what God's going to do. There's no wavering in this wise man's assertion of what God's going to do. There's nothing to add to it, and there's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear Him, that men should be in awe of Him, should respect Him. God's work is perfect. He designed it to be a certain way, and that's the way it's going to be. Now, if we see that in nature, right? Obviously, down to just the atom and atomic structure, all the way up to giant trees and mammals that live upon the earth. We see God's structure, and it is, when He made things, what did He say at the end of the day? It is good, right? It is good. Can we see that also in His design for our lives? There are times when it doesn't feel like it's that great, right? Can we also see it maybe in His design for the church? He set the church to be in its place and be designed how it needs to be. And then we come in and say, well, you know what? I'm going to move this around a little bit, and it's going to be so much better. Just watch. No. He set things in place to be the way they need to be. And then when we start monkeying with it, we mess things up, right? Abraham. God said, Abraham, I'm going to give you a son. By Sarah, right? And he said, well, I'm going to help you, God. I'm going to help you. I got, you know, this handmaiden over here, and we'll get this done, right? We'll get this done. And he tried to help God. What did he do? He made a mess of everything, right? We're still dealing with that issue, right? Thank you, Abraham, okay? So we try to help God sometimes, and we mess things up. We need to understand that God has things in control, right? He has things in control. There's a time for when things need to happen, and they're going to happen, but we need to be patient and waiting for those things. And so he says, these are the things that God has set in place. He said, that which has been has already, and that which will be has already been. For God seeks, God is sovereign in control of everything. Is God subject to time? No, He's not. It's a created thing. He sees everything for what it's been. So He's sovereign over history and everything. All right, so we're returning back to this concept of under the sun. And the cry for justice. He says, I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. We've never seen this, right? That's back then. We've evolved to be more civilized people. No, right, that's still the case, right? Men have not changed, and that is still the case. And what does he say? Well, I'm going to ride in on a white horse, and I'm going to take care of it. Verse 17, what does he say? That's right. In verse 17, I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. So that's what's going to happen. If you want to write out there, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5 talks about God judging the righteous and the wicked. If you also want to write out the Revelation chapter 6, verse 10. Revelation chapter 6, verse 10, there are those who are crying out from under the altar, how long will you hold judgment for the righteous saints that have been died, those that have been killed for the martyrs? How long will you wait? Right? And sometimes we wait a long time for justice. And sometimes we will go to our grave waiting on justice. But we need to make sure we understand that God's justice is much more complete than we could ever make our own judgment, our own justice, right? It is quite popular in the movies nowadays for the vigilante, right, to come in and take care of things because the police aren't doing their job and blah. And so that kind of romanticized idea of taking justice into our own hands. But in every aspect of those shows, what do we see typically? It doesn't always go well, right? There's always backlash. There's always something that happens. And God's justice can be more complete. And God's justice can be exactly what it needs to be. where ours is going to be just typically one-sided. And he's even said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And that is a hard lesson to learn. It is still a hard lesson to live by. But the only thing that helps me sleep at night sometimes is God can make him hurt more than I can, maybe. I mean, that's just, again, maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm confessing too much, but we'll move along, right? So that's just, you know, God is going to be more complete and more thorough in the job that needs to be done, especially in the idea of injustice and oppression. We're going to look at that quite a bit tonight. So the justice of God, the problem observed, we see it still today, God's ultimate judgment, and then God's testing, verses 18 and 19. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see what they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they are all have the same breath, and there's no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. Does God test? This is a trick. What's that? Well, let me go back. Does God tempt anyone? No, James makes that clear. That is not what we're talking about. That is not on the table. The word that's used here is a sense of purify, or a sense of something being proven, right? If you want to purify gold or test the quality of somebody's metal, what do you do with it? You surrender it to the fire, right? You put it into the fire. And so that's the idea that's being done here. God surely has tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. There was even a test that God gave with the men whenever they were going to go out with Gideon, right? About how they drank, if they drank like a beast or not, and to separate those that needed to be separated out. But what are we looking at here when talking about this fate of sons of men? If you read this whole verse 20 as well, let's put this up here. Does it go up there? Yeah, there it is. What is he getting at with this man versus beast concept? If you read all the way through to verse 22, what is he trying to say? That men are just like beasts, and when we die, we're dead all over like Rover? And is it that nihilistic concept that we kind of talked about early? Nihilism?
One has a future,
and one just dies. Yes. But is he even talking about the future, necessarily? Or is he just talking about death in general? Yeah, just death. Everybody's going to die, right? It kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Everything is going to die. In 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 2, when David is at the end of his life, he told Solomon, I am going the way of all the earth. Which is a fancy way of saying what? I'm going to die, right? I'm about to die. I'm going the way of all the earth. Everything goes this way, right? Everything dies. Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. Psalm 109, verse 29, Psalm 146, verse 4. Everything is going to die, okay? And so that is what we're getting at. We're not getting at this idea that we're all going to die and there's no future. We're not talking about future heaven or hell right now. We're just talking about death. And then that happens. And that there's no advantage. We're not going to escape death because we're human and there's animals. And so they all come to death. We all go to dust, all return back to dust. And also verse 21, who knows that the breath of the man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth. This is not a question as though he doesn't know, right? It's more of a question statement, a lot like Paul does in Corinthians. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? No. So it's those kind of statement. He's not saying, he's not in doubt, but people ignore the fact that there is something afterwards, right? They live like, I'm going to die and go to the dust. And they forget that, oh yeah, I have to balance my account at the end of my life. And so we need to make sure we understand that. And again, here we are last time. I've seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Are we going to live and see the future? Solomon says, be content in living the lot that you've been given, and that is where you're going to be. That's where you're going to be the happiest. And here's a man who has seen all these things and experienced all these things, great wisdom, and we need to understand that's what he's saying. We're going to find our greatest happiness, our greatest contentment, is being in that area. So the secret of satisfaction is learning to be content where God has placed us and what God has blessed us with in living in that area. Of course, there's other things, but broad brushstrokes that we're looking at. So we start another section here with chapter 4, more vanity in the world, vanity in earthly endeavor. In the earth, have people stopped suffering? No, that has kind of always been the case. There's always been those that have suffered. Again, we return to this concept of what's happening under the sun. Then I looked again. That idea, then I looked again, he says several times. He says it again in verse 7. That's sort of like a transitional phrase. Like that's how you transition from one thought to the next thought. And we have those kind of phrases in our own vocabulary. But then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which are being done under the sun. And what does he begin to see? What is he seeing? And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressor was power, but they had no one to comfort them. If people were living in that, would that be rather dreary? I won't have to get into that. But there are things that we see, there are injustices that are done, and we feel powerless to help, right? But who do we serve? This text says there's no one to comfort them. When Paul writes his letter to the Corinthian church, he says we serve the God of all comfort. All ye who are weary and are heavy laden, come unto me and I will give you rest. Why does that help? When we read the 23rd Psalm, why do we take comfort in reading the 23rd Psalm? Why is that read so often? The Lord is my shepherd, right? My refuge, right? So we see those things because we long for comfort. We know that we have either been in the place of being oppressed or needing where those were powerless against those that stand against us. We know, and we've seen people in that position. Yes, sir? Yes. And that's a very good point. We can't oppress the spiritual side of things. And even we read earlier, I had a note here to mention that the question of death, even we are victors even over death in the spiritual realm. I mean, our body, our physical tent has to die. But spiritually, we can be victors over even death because of Christ and victors over so much because of what God has done. And that's what he's trying to get to the point. And these things is that if we put God in perspective in these things, then things begin to change. But he's, like you're saying, seeing this, just the oppression, like with the Nazis is a very good example of oppression and those that have power. So much so, verse 2 and 3, what does he say about those who are dead? What did he say to the dead already? Yeah. Good for you, man, for dying already, because you're not having to live through this. It's better off. Better yet, even verse 3, if you weren't even born, if you never even existed, if you never even had to see all the evil activity that was under the sun, right? That's the kind of oppression he's talking about. And so he sees these things, and that is a truth. That is the evils of oppression. There's also things that we see as far as the pressures of successful, and I hinted at this earlier. I've seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry between man and his neighbor. This too is vanity, striving after the wind. Nobody does that anymore, do they? Who are we trying to keep up with? The Joneses, right? We even gave them a name, right? There's a kind of a proverb here: the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh, right? With a fool, it doesn't work. Is destruction, right? It's destruction to himself who doesn't work. And it's the fool who says, verse 6, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. That's a fool statement. That is that same concept of just, I better just sit here and do nothing. It's best to sit here and do nothing than to strive after something that's not going to come to anything. There's work we need to do. And there's scripture we need to cover. Okay, so the loneliness of the wealthy, chapter 4, 7 through 12. Then I looked again and vanity and under the sun, there was a certain man. When do we see like a there was a certain man or there was this guy and they start having this lesson, we call those parables, right? We see sort of a parabolic lesson here. There's a man, and what was he doing? What was this man doing? Chapter 4, verse 8. He labored, and who did he have to give it to? Nobody, right? His eyes were not satisfied in what he did, and he never asked the question, and for who am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? Have we seen people like that? We call them what? Workaholics, right? They just work and 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 work. They don't even have any. Like, I mean, and you're like, what are you doing, man? Like you have like all this fancy stuff, but you never drive it, you never use it, you never enjoy it. You're just working, 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 right? So there's that is vanity. And then that in contrast to that, he goes to the he goes into talking about. I've gone way too far, but anyway, that gives you. Kind of what we're looking at here. But in contrast, he says, two are better than one, right? Here's the passage that's read at weddings, right? Here's the wedding verse. There's first Corinthians chapter 13, and then there's this one, the other wedding passage. What are we looking at here? Two are better than one. Two are better than one, right? So what happened earlier? Here's this one guy working for himself, and he never gets to enjoy anything. But here's two people who are working together, are striving together, and you see he goes over and over the benefit of those two that are working together. Furthermore, if two lie down, one can keep warm, because you can't keep warm by yourself. And there's one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him, so it goes through over and over again. Three cord strands not quickly apart. We're not really going to, I think we'll be able to finish chapter 4 here. So, a poor and yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. Have you ever met somebody that just can't receive information? Like no matter how you try and tell them, they're just like, well, I know how to do it better, right? And you try and be patient and say, well, maybe if we do this, or like, no, I don't do this. This person says that they're foolish. They're foolish like a foolish king. For he was come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. So here's one who's a poor yet wise lad. Who was a poor yet wise lad that came out of prison and became king? This may be an homage to Joseph. See, it works, right? This may be an homage, kind of a tipping the hat towards Joseph here. In verse 15 and 16, we'll close out. I've seen all the living under the sun through the side of the second lad who replaces him. And there's no end to all the people and to all those who are before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him, for this is too is vanity and striving after the wind. Is everybody going to be content with what we do? No. Do we need to continue to strive to please everybody? No, because you will not be able to do. But if I'm doing what's right, living a life that's content and pleasing God, then there's nothing better than that. There's nothing better than that. Let's close with a prayer.